Gentlemen, thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one, record your name and affiliation. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over today to our host, John Bateman. Thank you. You may begin.
All right. Good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications. I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email at nsdis.pa@noaa.gov. That's nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. Today's update will feature two short presentations, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory, and I'll also spell it for you right now, so grab a pen. It's https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/sotc/briefings. And with that, I'll introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Deke Arndt, Chief of the Climate Monitoring Branch at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the March U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second speaker is Steve Baxter, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the next 3 months. Our first speaker will be Deke from NOAA. Deke?
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. I'm going to be speaking to our slide deck today, and we'll start at slide number two, global temperature for March 2020. The global temperature record does date back to 1880, so unless I say otherwise, comparisons are to a 141-year period of record. So March 2020 was the second warmest March on record. You can see it, and this is pretty much on all kind of the major facets of the globe. So the total global temperature, second warmest on record, that temperature over land and that temperature over the ocean were all second warmest on record, all behind March 2016. March 2016 happens to be of the roughly 1,680 months of the record, the largest temperature anomaly. So March 2016 is kind of the all-time champ throughout the record. This month placed second to that. It is in a three-way tie for the third highest anomaly in the entire record. So March 2020 tied with last month, February 2020, and December 2015 as the third warmest month relative to the 20th century average in of all months on record. Only February and March 2016, when a strong El Nino was present, had larger anomalies. For a long-term perspective, this was the 44th consecutive March and the 423rd consecutive month that was at least nominally warmer than the 20th century average. And then March has warmed about 1.25 degrees Fahrenheit over the last three decades. That's 0.7 degrees Celsius since 1991. Looking at the map, looking around, about 8% of the Earth's surface had a record warm March, and those areas show up in kind of the darkest red on the map. South America as a continent had its warmest March on record, as did Argentina in South America. France was above its average temperature for the 10th month in a row. This is their first run of that length. And according to our European colleagues, Moscow had its Russia had its second warmest March of a 200-year record. So it's quite warm in the Atlantic, in Europe, and in Asia, as you can see on the map. A little closer to the U.S., the Caribbean had its second warmest March. The Gulf of Mexico had its warmest March on record, and we'll come back to that when we talk about the United States. The northern hemisphere warmth, particularly in Eurasia, was consistent with a positive Arctic Oscillation Index, which described in ways that the jet stream is pulled farther north and kind of allows warmer conditions to take hold in parts of the northern hemisphere. It was quite the index was quite positive, indicating kind of a tendency for that, and the way the temperatures played out kind of reinforced that. Speaking of the warmth in Eurasia, snow and ice, there was about 930,000 square miles of, quote, missing northern hemisphere snow versus the 1981 to 2010 average. That's the fifth smallest on record since the mid-1960s, and it was almost entirely driven by missing snow in Eurasia and Europe in particular. Arctic sea ice tends to expand to its largest footprint over the month of March, and this year it was small. That footprint was small compared to the long-term period of record, the 11th smallest out of a little more than 40 years on record. It was the 17th consecutive March that was smaller than that record. Antarctic sea ice landed right about in the middle of its history for March. Moving to slide number three and thinking about the global temperature from January through March, the first 3 years of the first 3 months of the year, and kind of consider this like a 12-lap race, three laps into the race. The globe itself is also the second warmest on record for the first quarter. It's second warmest to 2016, which you can see on this graphic. I should note that January through March 2020, both Europe and Asia had their warmest first quarter on record, globally second warmest. You can see the upper graphic here shows kind of the first 3 months of 2020 in black. These are the cumulative kind of average temperatures. So the black dot on the left represents the January temperature anomaly. The second black dot represents the average of January and February. The third black dot represents the average of January, February, and March. Clearly second warmest behind what was a very warm first quarter in 2016. The way the kind of statistics play out, the other colors on that graphic happen to be the 10 warmest years on record and kind of how they played out over the year. So three laps into a 12-lap race, 2020 is close behind 2016. It is virtually certain, almost a null probability that it won't happen, that it will be one of the 10 warmest years on record. It is almost certain that it'll be one of the five warmest years, that 2020 will finish as one of the five warmest years on record. And there's about a 3 out of 4 chance, according to our analysis, that 2020 will end up being the warmest year on record. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the year 2016 became the warmest year on record, largely because it was very, very warm in the first half of the year, and it was actually not nearly as impressively warm in the second half of the year. So the way the stats play out is by staying close to 2016 early on, it does look like there's a better than half probability that we will finish the year warmest on record. Looking at the U.S., slide number four, this was the 10th warmest March on record for the United States. The temperature was 46.1 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 4.5 degrees warmer than the 20th century average. And it was a slightly wet month as well, averaged across the country, with about a third of an inch above the 20th century average for precipitation. Looking at the map, you can see that the heat relative to history was focused mostly on the coastal south and the coastal east. That was where the main warmth happened. If you remember, we talked about the Gulf of Mexico being warmest on record as a body of water. The adjacent parts of the United States were also warmest on record. So these statewide values of Florida being warmest on record and much of the Deep South being second or third warmest on record, as you can see with those numbers, the coastal regions of those states actually were warmest on record as being adjacent to the Gulf. Florida was, as I mentioned, very warm. This was particularly true for peninsular Florida, particularly kind of in the central belt across Orlando. That was quite warm and quite dry in March. Overall, nationally speaking, we estimate that the residential energy demand was about the 10th lowest on record for March, representing a lot of warmth in population-dense areas of the East. So low residential energy demand. So just kind of around the country, Portland, Maine had its earliest 70-degree Fahrenheit day on record, beat its old record. That happened on March 9th. That beat the old record by 5 days. The most unusually warm county relative to their own history was Clayburgh County, Texas, in South Texas. It was 10 degrees warmer than its 20th century average March. We did see some tornadoes in March. It was a fairly active month. It was nominally more active than the average March, but not by much. We saw three major outbreaks, one on the 2nd and 3rd, which produced the storms across the Mid-South and particularly near Nashville, which resulted in about 25 fatalities across much of Tennessee. There was an outbreak on March 18th in Central Texas, and then on the last day of the month across the Deep South. For the year-to-date for the United States, Alaska was cool. It had its coldest January, February, and March since 2012. North Carolina and Florida are now working on their warmest year-to-date on record. And from a precipitation standpoint, San Juan, Puerto Rico had its wettest January through March on record. It was more than 2.5 times the normal precipitation, and they're already 13.5 inches tracking above normal. The next slide is slide number 5, and this is another look at temperatures during March 2020. But what we've broken out is on the left, we're looking at maximum temperatures or afternoon temperatures. And on the right, we're looking at minimum temperatures, which are kind of overnight low temperatures or morning low temperatures. And you can see a real difference in the afternoon temperatures versus the morning temperatures. Much of the coastal Gulf states and part up to the Mid-Atlantic, you see the dark red on the map on the right, minimum temperatures. Those counties had their warmest mornings on average on record for March. You can see how much larger that footprint was compared to the afternoon temperatures. And then when you look at the next color on the scale, the kind of darker orange color, that's the top 10%. And that takes up about half the country, kind of emanating from the Gulf of Mexico, whereas afternoon temperatures weren't that dramatically warm in much of the Midwest. So this warm March in the United States was really driven by overnight lows kind of dominating the – pushing the needle much more than afternoon highs, and that's really consistent with what we've seen in much of the warm season and even the transition seasons over the last decade or so. We're seeing, again, a continuing scene where morning temperatures – are warming at a way that are outpacing the warming of afternoon temperatures in many, many months during the last decade. Finally, I want to focus on drought in the United States on slide 6. As of this Tuesday morning, April 14th, about 14.5% of the contiguous U.S. was in drought. That's up from about 11.5% at the beginning of March. It intensified and expanded across much of the Pacific Northwest, basically from the San Francisco Bay northward. We did see some expansion and some drought intensification after a dry couple weeks beginning in March. We saw along those coastal regions, which were very warm and very dry, we did see drought intensify right along the Gulf Coast, and what we call a flash drought kind of manifested on the Florida Peninsula. And a flash drought often occurs in warm places or during the warm season. And when it's quite dry and very warm, we can see things dry down very quickly. And so the drought that you see in Peninsular Florida basically emerged over the course of a few weeks, which is pretty rapid in the drought world. So we're keeping track of that. We did see marginal improvements in South Texas, and we saw some improvements in Southern California, just southwest of the Four Corners as well, as we saw a wet pattern for parts of March. Outside the contiguous U.S., the U.S.-affiliated Pacific Islands are seeing some significant dry down. Wokia in the Republic of the Marshall Islands has reached D3 status, and we don't often talk about drought outside the contiguous U.S., but the Pacific Islands are seeing some drought in their part of the world. I will stop there and hand it off to our colleague Steve Baxter for slide 7.
Thanks, Deke. Great presentation. Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm picking up on slide 7 with sea surface temperatures and El Nino Southern Oscillation. So starting with the top figure there on the left, we see sea surface temperatures across the equatorial Pacific are largely above normal. They actually extend across the entire equatorial Pacific, and this is something we've seen more or less for the past several months. We've been bordering on kind of warm neutral to weak El Nino conditions, but not quite reaching the threshold required for an El Nino advisory. And if you look further north in the extratropical or the mid-latitude Pacific there, you see a large area of positive SST anomalies extending from the east coast of Asia eastward across near just south of 40 degrees north, extending into the northeast Pacific. Looking a little bit closer to North America, one thing you see is that the Gulf of Mexico SSTs are actually at record highs now, at least going back several decades. And that's pretty impressive. There is a warming trend there, but nonetheless, the sea records right now for the warmest SSTs in the Gulf of Mexico is pretty impressive. And those extend at lower amplitude up the eastern seaboard as well. Looking off the west coast, this includes over much of Alaska as well. Sea surface temperatures are actually near normal from all the way down to the California coast, extending up along the entire coast of North America to Alaska, where we actually see some sea ice that's been a little bit above normal parts of Alaska. They actually had an unusually cold season, which is kind of remarkable given the long-term warming trends there, which is something of interest to note. Last thing about sea surface temperatures is looking in the North Atlantic, there's this persistent area of below-normal sea surface temperatures that you see there southeast of Greenland. And this tends to occur in a little bit of what we call a tripole pattern. So if you look at that, and you look just south of that region across kind of near 30 degrees north, there's a local maximum where the colors are darker. And if you go down into the tropics there, there's another little minimum there. And so this can be related to decadal variability in the North Atlantic. It can have important implications for hurricanes as well as climate over North America on longer timescales. So it's kind of an interesting thing. We're not sure what to make of it entirely, but it's one of the interesting things that we're watching. And then moving on to the ENSO forecast, of course, ENSO stands for the El Nino Southern Oscillation. So we're looking at the state of that system and whether or not we favor La Nina or El Nino. And so as you go through the next several months, we're basically favoring a transition from these weekly positive SST anomalies across the equatorial Pacific to more negative sea surface temperature anomalies or colder than normal temperatures developing across especially parts of the central and eastern equatorial Pacific. And so ENSO neutral is likely to persist through the summer and into the fall, but the chances of La Nina do increase to about 35% to 40% by late winter or early fall. So that's specifically favored, but more likely than El Nino. So El Nino is unlikely in 2020, but not impossible. About around closer to 20%. And so this does inform some of our thinking going forward with the forecast. If we're looking at changes in sea surface temperatures over the equatorial Pacific from this past winter to next winter, for example, on the order of 0.5 to 1 degree Celsius, which is another change to cause changes in the large-scale pattern of tropical convection that can be important for influencing weather and climate in the mid-latitudes. So moving on to slide 8, this is the monthly forecast for the month of May. So on the left, we have the temperature forecast. On the right, we have the precipitation forecast. Of course, our forecasts are probabilistic in nature, so this is the probability of falling in one of these historical terciles, the upper, middle, or lower third of the 1981 to 2010 climate record. And what you see here is above normal temperatures favored in this kind of horseshoe pattern that we see a lot this time of year that's informed largely by long-term trends as the background, but then influenced by things like the sea surface temperature patterns, both in the tropics and the extratropics. Soil moisture can play a big role, especially for this month, as well as more explicit connections to El Nino, La Nina, which, of course, we're not expecting for May, given we're very much entrenched in these neutral El Nino conditions. And so over this area where equal chances is indicated, which is the climatological distribution, there were some conflicting signals, but soil moisture would favor where there's anomalously wet soils across much of the central U.S. there, would favor cooler solution, and then combine that with long-term trends as well as the other guidance, kind of nets out, kind of gets you back to climatology, so to speak. And so a lot of ways, especially across parts of the central and southeastern U.S., while the forecast is equal chances, is actually quite a bit cooler than the long-term trend by itself would indicate. So some of those nuanced points just try to communicate that there are some interesting things happening, and there was a central clearness that gets us to the point where we just kind of favor the climatological distribution. Transitioning to precipitation, we are favoring kind of a broad area of slightly elevated probabilities of above normal precipitation across much of the central and southeastern U.S. And then further northwest, there is a small area favoring below normal precipitation for parts of the Pacific Northwest and southwestern Alaska. And this is kind of consistent overall if we imagine what this kind of large-scale atmospheric stress relation looks like, which tends to favor a little bit more of a weakness in the central U.S. and allows for the anomalous or relatively normal transfer of moisture northward from what is currently a very, very warm Gulf of Mexico. So that also plays into this as well. All right, moving on to slide 9. This is a seasonal forecast. This is the May, June, July seasonal average. You can see it's quite a bit warmer, and some of those effects in the monthly forecast kind of time out when we start to go back toward the low-frequency climate state. But this still is a little bit cooler than a long-term trend, especially in parts of the central U.S. and the southeastern U.S. But areas near the coast, interior west, New England, as well as southern Alaska, are where we have these local maxima favoring above normal temperatures. And that's really well specified by a lot of our both statistical forecast models as well as our kind of coupled dynamical forecast models that really agree on this pattern quite well. Looking at the precipitation pattern, this pattern really comes very closely to the long-term trends, but some of that is taking with the dynamical models that we're predicting, which is a little bit of a wetter solution over the Rockies, and actually shifting it east a little bit based on the statistical guidance like trends, but also looking at some of the circulation patterns that are being forecast in the dynamical models. And for instance, some of the forecast circulation that we're seeing over the North Pacific in the coming months looks a little bit more consistent with patterns that we might see during a weak La Nina-type conditions as the system starts to transition a little bit more toward a colder neutral as we head through the summer and towards the fall. And if you look at our other forecasts on our webpage, you'll see that this effect of kind of the subtle transition from warmer than normal to colder than normal without explicitly going into La Nina does have some subtle impact on the forecast moving, especially into the fall. And then finally, slide 10 here, looking at the U.S. drought outlook. This is from the valid technically starting today, but going through the end of July. And what you see here is what is a fairly straightforward drought outlook as far as drought outlooks go, because we have areas of precipitation, probabilistic precipitation forecasts that are fairly large in coverage. So, for instance, we do have areas where we're favoring wetter or drier conditions for the seasonal average, which is helpful. Plus, we also have the effect of climatology itself. So, for instance, over the Gulf Coast, southern Texas, Florida Peninsula, that region there is expected to see improvement or removal in drought based on how severe it currently is. And that's because, one, that we are slightly favoring above normal precipitation, but also we're really going into the wet season there. So, for instance, the wet season of Florida really starts to get kicked off here over the next couple months, and that's going to help alleviate some of that drought in spite of the above normal temperatures being favored there. So Deke was mentioning this flash drought that developed because it was so hot, combined with the fact that it was dry and in a drier time of year, and that was kind of a perfect recipe to develop drought very quickly there. But similarly, as quick as it came, we are forecasting some improvement there as we head into the wet season with some above normal precipitation favored on top of that. Transitioning to the West Coast, where we have kind of the climatological dry season, especially along the immediate West Coast, combined with the fact that we're favoring below normal precipitation as well as above normal temperatures, that helps us to have a little bit more confidence in persistence or development in drought that are currently already tilting toward the abnormally dry side. And then where you see a little bit of the transition zone there is over the parts of the High Plains, Northeast Colorado, and that's where we are favoring a little bit of above normal precipitation there extending over northeastern Colorado, combined with heading into a little bit of a wetter time of year, favoring removal of kind of pretty modest drought there for the time being. Okay, so I will now turn it back to John for the question and answer session.
All right, thanks a lot, Steve.
So now it is time to take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question, if possible, either Deke or Steve. Charles, please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Yes, sir. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question today, please press star 1 and record your first name and your affiliation, please. One moment while we collect questions. Okay, and our first question comes from Ryan Schelling from Bloomberg News. Your line is now open.
Thank you. So I guess the big question I have here is, what's causing the oceans to be so warm, and how is that oceanic heat translating to the rest of the globe? Is it the land that's heating the oceans up, or is it the oceans that are heating the land up?
Hi there. This is Deke from NCEI. I'll take the first shot at this. So the overall big picture, so we're talking about kind of a what we would call like a nesting of scales, right? So over different time windows and over different sizes of geography, there are different processes that go on. So I'm going to roughly talk to long-term and short-term and large-scale and small-scale across those, and I'm oversimplifying a lot. But yeah. In the long term, what's driving the long-term warming of the oceans and the land are increased greenhouse gases, so additional heat trapped by greenhouse gases. So from kind of the if you laid a line across several years, across a few decades, kind of stretching back to the mid-ish 20th century, the long-term trend is almost entirely driven by increases in greenhouse gases. And that long-term warming provides a background context upon which a lot of the dynamics of the oceans and the atmosphere, which tend to move blobs of heat and cold around those two systems, work. And so what we saw in the U.S., like particularly with the Gulf of Mexico, was a combination of patterns in the atmosphere that helped kind of set up high pressure in particularly over the Gulf of Mexico and adjacent parts, what we would call ridging as meteorologists. That added to the fact that the Gulf of Mexico has been running quite warm for many months now. That's probably what helped kind of push it over the top. As far as whether the lands drive the oceans or the oceans drive the land in the short term on the scales of weather, the ocean remembers and holds on to heat and change much more. The patterns in the oceans change much more slowly than the patterns in the atmosphere. So from that kind of short, narrow window, the oceans are important for kind of influencing where the large-scale weather patterns that pull cold and warm air around, and Steve could read you chapter and verse on many of the relationships that we see. But the oceans are an important factor in influencing how and where and in what direction the big weather systems tend to go over kind of the weeks to months period. I apologize that that wasn't a definitive answer, but there isn't really a definitive answer on that. The climate system is a lot like our lifetime. They're very complex, and they're filled with many, many ingredients. Some of those ingredients are long-term, and some of those ingredients are immediate. And it's the combination of those that leads to the outcomes that we see month to month.
Yeah, let me just follow up. That was a great answer by Deke. This is Steve. Just to mention that one of the things that you can do that we like to do at CPCU, where we focus more on climate variability, as Deke mentioned, looking at long-term trends, right, to a first order, you can explain most of that with greenhouse gas emissions, right, the long-term secular change. But when you remove that effect, you still do get some of these interesting patterns of variability. And so you focus on that. Some of the patterns we're seeing, I was mentioning that North Atlantic tripole-type pattern, or looking at that Pacific kind of tongue of warm water coming off the east coast of Asia across the Pacific there. Those do correspond with some fairly canonical patterns related to North Pacific and North Atlantic interannual to decadal SST variability. So that can be important on climate time scales and to some extent in the warm season. As Steve mentioned, in the atmosphere, the oceans remember the atmosphere, and that's certainly true. And in the case of these mid-latitude SST anomalies in the cold season, they tend to be very much driven by the atmosphere because the atmospheric dynamics are very robust. And so they're very, because of internal and even chaotic variability in the mid-latitude dynamics, you can impart all kinds of SST anomalies. In the summertime, that effect is weakened a little bit, and the SSTs are allowed, if you will, to exert a little bit more of an influence, even from the extratropics, because the atmospheric dynamics are less interesting in the summertime. Because the sun's up all over the northern hemisphere, we don't get these big temperature gradients like we do in the winter. And then all year round, we like to look at the tropical Pacific because that can affect these convective patterns that affect the relative strength and position of the jet stream, especially in the cold season, but even to some extent in the warm season. So just wanted to add on, give a little bit more of that variability perspective to Deke's answer, but I think it's a great question.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Ken Newton from St. Joseph News. Your line is now open.
Hi. I have a question about slides 9 and 10. So I guess it's Steve, but either one, if you have a comment about it. You know, there's a great many factors that go into flooding. I know this isn't about hydrology, but I was wondering, since there's going to be equal temperatures, chances are May through July above average precipitation. Is there anything in the data today that would suggest another flood year like Northwest Missouri and the Missouri River watershed had last year?
Hey, this is Steve. Another great question. I can't stray too far outside my lane into the hydrology aspect of it explicitly. But certainly there are some similarities that are borne out in the forecast this year versus last year. But keep in mind also that the forecasts here are very modest probabilities. Last month, NOAA CPC did contribute to the NOAA Spring Outlook, which includes a flood outlook for April, May, June. And so I might consult that if I were you for a little bit more nuanced discussion of looking at the kind of the spring, early summer flood season across the central U.S. and how, you know, antecedent as well as forecast conditions might affect that. I don't want to go beyond that, except to say that while broad parts of the spatial pattern are similar, the amplitude that we saw last year was remarkable and can't be explained by just the low-frequency climate factors that are going into this outlook, for instance. So a little bit of a cop-out answer, but I went to in broad terms, the spatial patterns are similar, but we are not, emphasis not, forecasting the type of amplitude that we saw last year because that type of event requires a lot more going on than what we can diagnose just looking at low-frequency climate factors.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Doyle Rice from USA Today. Your line is now open.
Good morning. Thanks for doing this. Question for Deke is just how unusual is it that does it seem pretty unusual that this warmth is so planet-wide in the absence of an El Nino? I mean, are there other years that have been anything like this in without an El Nino? Is this pretty remarkable or unusual, would you say?
Hi, Doyle. This is Deke. Thanks. Great question. First of all, I'll preface it by first of all, on this call, Steve is definitely the expert on kind of how El Nino and so work and the interplay between the ocean and the atmosphere. So what I'm about to say is kind of a cartoon version of what he could say. I'm only looking at the El Nino as a factor in global temperatures. And in the Pacific Ocean, the part of the ocean that folks like Steve look to help advise their assessment of El Nino, as he said, is kind of in a neutral condition, but it has been on the warm side of the neutral status for a while now. And so while it's technically ENSO neutral and it has been kind of, you know, on the warm side of the 50-yard line, I'll put it that way. And so but with that said, yes, it is unusual. These are the warmest months, February and 2020 and March 2020, the warmest months that we've seen in the planet's record that haven't been accompanied by a full-blown El Nino. So, you know, we often talk on this call, and I know I've mentioned it before, that the long-term temperature, the secular trend that Steve talked about, the long-term warming, is a lot like riding on an escalator. And the longer you stay on that escalator, the higher you go. And that's kind of that first-order signal. Things like El Nino and La Nina kind of cycling through are like jumping up and down while you're – or standing up tall and crouching down while you're riding up that escalator. And so while we aren't in the stand as tall as you can, full-blown El Nino stage, we aren't exactly crouching down either. So the combination of the long-term warming and this kind of warmish side of neutral so far in the last few months, I think has brought us to this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just to reiterate what Dee said, that was great. And the one thing that you know, he has that's perfect is that, you know, ENSO on global temperatures is kind of just helping to contribute to those little spikes up and down, like you mentioned, kind of jumping up and down as you're riding up on the trend. And one of the things that that you know, you can quantify this with some numbers, but basically the El Nino La Nina system, you know, it only explains a few percentage points of the variance in the global temperature. So it does help get you to those peaks and valleys as you're going up. But it's not gonna fundamentally explain huge deviations from normal the way the trend will. The one thing that's in between those two is this decadal variability that is harder to monitor because it takes such a long time to unfold, and so we're never really comfortable assessing exactly what decadal state we're in relative to, like, for example, the North Pacific and North Atlantic, and those can have effects that are bigger than El Nino but smaller than the trend in terms of the overall global average temperature and the variability of that over long periods of time.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Rebecca Hirsch from National Public Radio. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this. I think this question is probably for Deke. I'm wondering whether the hot water in the Gulf of Mexico is expected to persist into the summer, and that's a little bit outside your lane, but if it does, is it natural to expect that that could lead to a more active hurricane season?
Hi, Rebecca. Thanks. This is Deke. I will defer to Steve on any matters of prediction. So, Steve, I'm sorry to punt this to you, man, but I think you're probably better positioned to answer that.
That's fine. And I will say, certainly we don't do, we're not issuing an official hurricane forecast until May. I'm not going to speak on the effect of the season. But that's a great point. I was actually just off a call where we were, you know, as forecasters, saying, you know, with such warm SSTs in the tropical, subtropical Gulf of Mexico, then, yeah, absolutely we need to be on the lookout for the possibility of early season development, only because, you know, tropical cyclone development, we can boil it down to a function of two things. One is just the basic thermodynamics of how warm the sea surface temperatures are that we can, from which we can extract the latent heat required to drive these big cyclones. And then the other thing is more dynamical, related to the, you know, how much of this change in the wind speed and direction with height that we have. And so just isolating one little part of the equation, it's going to be super warm there. So if you do get a favorable dynamic environment, it would, you know, give you a better opportunity to, for an early season development there. Again, probably a pretty small signal relative to the range of possibilities. But sure, yeah, looking at something that's that anomalously warm, it would, you know, it certainly wouldn't hurt to a first order to look at that and say, yep, you know, there might be a better average shot at early season development there. However, I can't quantify that. This is just kind of a hand-waving argument, just looking at, hey, yeah, the warmest temperatures on pretty much on the globe, actually. If you look at that map on slide 7, the local areas of the Gulf of Mexico are about as anomalously warm as anywhere else. And when you standardize it, if you were to divide it by climatological standard deviation, it might be even more impressive than other parts on the globe. So it's definitely a big signal. The other thing you mentioned is that it's going to persist. Well, we're still in the time of year where you can change Gulf of Mexico sea surface temperatures if we get a late season cold front that gets pretty far south. The circulation patterns can still affect that. So, you know, we're not making a forecast past like May just because of the time period. So if it goes through into June, for instance, you know, will it stay as anomalously warm? We're really not prepared to say that, but certainly it'll be warmer than normal. You know, will it be as warm as now? I'm not sure. And yes, that would, you know, all things being equal, would be a little bit more favorable if you were to get other things line up for some early season development. But I don't, again, not making a forecast, therefore, necessarily not quantifying it, but just kind of isolating that simple kind of thermodynamic part of it would be helpful.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Foyer from Richmond Times. Your line is now open.
Hi, yeah. Thanks so much for doing this. And that last question did kind of touch on what I was going to ask, but I will put it back to Steve and kind of counter it with what would we look for in a dynamical signal that could maybe help mitigate our summertime vulnerability along the eastern seaboard if indeed we do have more activity driven by those warm sea surface temperatures?
Hey, this is Steve again. Great question. So what you're looking for are kind of, you know, increased what we call vertical wind shear, but this is the tendency of the winds to vary with both speed and direction as you ascend upward through the atmosphere. And basically, the more vertical wind shear you have, the less conducive it is for tropical cyclones to form. So the season for tropical cyclone development is governed just by basically those two things. How warm is it? There's a certain kind of theoretical threshold that you have to be past in terms of sea surface temperature to have the amount of energy available to spin up tropical cyclones. But then also, what does this wind profile look like? And it gets more conducive as we go through the warm season. So typically, you still tend to be kind of shear limited during certain parts of the season, very early, very late in the season, where you start to get you still have a lot of very impressive dynamics that are going on that are more related to the extratropical high and low pressure systems and such, and those tend to inhibit tropical cyclone formation in large part. So that's kind of the give and take that you would look at there. I don't want people to say that I'm predicting more storms along the East Coast, because those other factors aren't known yet, and we don't know how much and at what amplitude these SSTs will persist. But just isolating that one point would be favorable, but these other factors are very important. And that actually, I mean, this goes into the very complicated, very complex literature regarding things like climate change and tropical cyclones, right? Because tropical cyclones are complicated things, so it's not just as easy as, oh, it's warmer, more of them. There are nuances there. You know, you have to consider what effect this has on, for instance, this change in wind speed with height, and, you know, then there are issues with respect to frequency and magnitude. It gets complicated. I don't want to oversimplify it beyond what we can, which is to simply say, yeah, in all other things being equal, having anomalously warm SSTs in the Gulf of Mexico especially, would help with the development of early season tropical cyclones. It is important that even though the season temperatures are warm in Gulf of Mexico, right now they're really only warm enough in the southern part of that basin as we head into late April. So, you know, you're looking for where the actual temperatures exceed a certain threshold. So, yeah, it's a great question. I hope I'm not dodging it too much, trying to provide some information, but it's also pretty complex, so I don't want to boil it down too much.
No, I appreciate it. We'll stay tuned. Thanks.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Denise Chow. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thanks so much for doing this. My question, I think, is for Deke. The slide number 3 on the year-to-date global temperatures. I was wondering if you could provide some more details on the probability of 2020 being the warmest year on record. The 74.7% figure, are you seeing trends that suggest that the subsequent quarters of this year could surpass 2016? Thanks.
Hi, Denise. Thank you very much. Great question. So, yes, this model that we run is basically uses the past behavior from the last 40 years of global temperatures on a month-by-month basis to kind of construct a composite of frankly, 10,000 different kind of outcomes based on kind of the statistical behavior of the last 40 years. And so for the remaining 9 months of the year, about three-quarters of those runs ended up with 2020 eclipsing, at least nominally, eclipsing 2016 because most of those runs did not generate the fairly significant decline that we saw after like May or June of 2016. So if you consider this like a 12-lap race, essentially, and 2020 is kind of in the running alongside 2016, the massive lead that 2016 built against all those other competitors on the graphic, 2020 has stayed close enough over 3 months such that statistically speaking, when you kind of put all of the last four decades of evidence together, that it appears more likely than not that 2020 will not see those rapid declines. I'll caveat that with the fact that this particular model does not pay attention to the status of El Nino, which is can be a factor. So I think, you know, as Steve mentioned, that they're tracking kind of the status of the ENSO system and that La Nina has a real decent chance of developing over the course of the rest of the year, that this will react to that rather than predict that, those outcomes. But for now, that's what's going on. The fact that 2016's last 6 or 7 months were relatively unimpressive compared to the rest of the 2000 teams is what's kind of generating that outcome.
Thank you.
You bet.
And that was our last question, so I'll turn it over to you, John.
All right, thanks, Charles. If there are no further questions, I will wrap up the call and then make a few announcements. First, I would like to thank all of our speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in this conference call. I will remind you guys to mark your calendar for some upcoming releases in May. First, the release of the April 2020 U.S. climate statistics is scheduled for May 6th. The release of the April 2020 global climate statistics is scheduled for May 13th. NOAA's 2020 Atlantic Hurricane Outlook will be at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, May 21st, and the media telecon for the April U.S. and Global Climate Report will be at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Friday, May 22nd. Finally, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov Media Advisory site later today. If you have any further informational needs, please email me at john.jones-batman@noaa.gov. My contact information is also available at the top of the media advisory. This concludes today's call. Thank you.
Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please.